We're going to be speaking on the morning show today with Jeffrey Makoff, who is the co-author, along with Rhoda Makoff, of a very interesting book and potentially life-changing book called Get Off the Fence, 10 and 1 Steps to Help You Make That Big Decision. All of us at one point or another in our lives will be confronted by a big decision, a very important choice, which we might have to make. And most of us confront those not fully equipped to deal with them. And this book just might make a very, very positive difference for you. We have with us on the phone Jeffrey Makoff, who actually is an attorney and co-chair and CEO of Digital Custom Group Incorporated. He and his wife, Rhoda Makoff, have really helped a lot of people, consulted with them to help confront some of the big decisions which confront them. And we talk with Jeffrey Makoff for a few minutes now about his book. Jeffrey Makoff, we welcome you to
Thank
the
you.
Morning
nice
show.
To be here.
First of all, do you pull from your own personal life or personal history very much in the writing of this book?
No, not really. Certainly the book is based upon the experience that I have and the experience that my co-author has. But the book is not about us. It's not a biography or an autobiography. It's a book that gives advice on how to make big decisions.
One of the things which is very interesting to me is the step one of your 10 and 1 steps that you suggest for people. And that is that you really have to sort out exactly what it is that you need to decide. You say, make the real decision and dump the decoys. What sort of decoys might confuse the issue for a given person?
Well, there are as many decoys as there are people. The theory of the decoy and the practice of the decoy is that we gravitate toward decisions that are comfortable, but not always the decision that moves us forward. Therefore, a typical decoy might be someone who deliberates for a year or two whether they should break up with someone when there's really no relationship left there, but they don't want to take that final step to have that conversation and break up the relationship, and so they deliberate endlessly about whether they should break up, when the real issue in that kind of situation is often, how do I break up?
Mm. Yeah, you say decoys start out innocently as a way for us to avoid or cope with pain. It's really a sidestepping mechanism.
It's a way of making a decision and temporarily feeling like we're taking a step in the right direction or working on it, when in fact we often are avoiding the real decision altogether because it's too big for us to grasp.
Hmm. You encourage someone in trying to sort through this to really confront those decoys with what you call active skepticism. Explain what you think active skepticism is.
Well, active skepticism applies especially well when a decoy decision is being foisted on you by another person. Quite often in business and in personal life, someone will come up to you and say, you have two choices. You can do A or you can do B. Well, it's important to be skeptical when other people are defining your choices, because there may be a third choice or a fourth choice, but that choice doesn't serve the interest of the person who's presenting them to you. Classic example is when a parent says, either you live with my drinking problem or you move out of the house because this is my house. Well, that looks very black and white, and the parent who has the problem would like the child to think that those are the only two choices, but there's a third choice. The child can take steps to intervene and try to stop that drinking problem.
Hmm. But that might be a choice that they shy away from.
It very well might be. It's a difficult step, and it's a big step, but it's critical when making the decision how to manage, for example, a parent with a drinking problem, that you understand all of your choices and not just focus on the choices that, in this case, the victim or the person who has the substance abuse problem is giving you.
Hmm. You state in this chapter a quote by Charles Kettering, which says, a problem well stated is a problem half solved. That really, in a nutshell, talks about the kind of the essential heart of this, that the identification of a problem, it might sound simplistic, but it really is absolutely essential to arriving eventually at a proper and helpful choice or decision.
Well, it's critical, because making decisions that aren't going to solve the problem or aren't going to move you forward won't get you anywhere, except temporarily maybe make you think that you're making progress. But what you're really doing there is you're avoiding the change that's going to move your life ahead. And that's not where you want to be in the long term.
We should mention at this point that one of the choices that you make, you and your co-author, in writing this book, is that you discuss each step, and then at the end of each chapter is a real-life story in which that particular facet of all this is played out. Tell us about the decision which you made to approach all of this from in this particular way.
Well, the big decision we made when we wrote this book was to communicate with a consumer audience. It would have been easy for us to put together a highly technical book on decision theory that was meant for lawyers and academic people to read, but that's not what we wanted to do. We wanted to take our experience and put it in a context that a lot of people would enjoy reading and that they would find interesting and fascinating. And we looked around at what people like, how they like to be communicated to, and we found that lately, especially with books like Chicken Soup for the Soul and similar books, people really want to read stories about other people, and they want to get inside the heads of other people and understand what happened in situations that people faced more or less like what they faced.
For instance, the real-life story which ends Chapter 1 is with someone named Catherine Conley, whose father has suffered a massive stroke, and she is confronted with enormous decisions about how he should be cared for. And it's interesting because, of course, I might not face that particular choice in my life. I hope I don't. But I will face other enormous choices or challenges. And you think Catherine Conley's story is going to somehow be helpful or applicable to me?
Oh, there's so much, especially in that particular story, that people can gain. First of all, most people will have life support decisions to make in their lifetime. We have the graying of the baby boom generation, and the number of people who are in their 30s and 40s who are going to be making decisions about life support for parents over the next 20 years is truly awesome. A lot of people are going to be faced with the decisions. But other lessons that can be learned from the story have to do with your own life support decisions. What should you be doing now to make sure that if you have, in the case of Catherine Conley, a 24-year-old daughter or son who has to make a decision for you, are you giving them proper guidance? What can you do? What small steps can you take so that the decision that your own child has to make is not so painful?
Well, once we have figured out what the big decision really is that we might be wanting to avoid, it's interesting in Chapter 2, which your Step 2, you say then that we have to take that big challenge or big problem and we have to break it up into small pieces. So,
go ahead.
So at the first, you're telling us, you know, don't avoid those big problems. But then, of course, one way we can actually deal with them effectively is to not leave them as big problems, but to break them into components that we can kind of digest and handle maybe more effectively.
Exactly. This is a common misconception that skilled decision makers are very good at dealing with big, complex issues. And what you learn when you work with people who are very skilled at making tough decisions is that they're no better than anybody else at complex issues. What they're good at is taking a complex issue and making it into a bunch of simple issues and then resolving them. And this is a skill that lawyers and doctors have to master. Someone sits in front of you in the office and relates this story that's all over the place. First meetings are always like this. The story's all over the place. And the lawyers and the doctors say, okay, this is what I'm hearing. These are the core issues. I'm going to address one. I'm going to address two. I'm going to address three. And the rest of it, I'm going to disregard.
You talk about let's write things down, first of all. Let's try to sort this out. And you think it's important that we think about wants and concerns and practical factors, that separation can really be helpful.
Yeah, this is a comment on the historical way that people think that decisions are made, and that's with a list of pros and cons. I have to say, I've never made a decision with a list of pros and cons. I've seen very few people who can successfully make a decision that way. I think it's not clear what the list of pros and cons adds. So what we say is don't think of it in terms of pros and cons. Think of it in terms of what you want to get out of the decision, what your concerns are about the decision, and what the practical limitations are. And each of those has a meaning, and we talk about that.
In Chapter 3, we kind of start talking about ignorance or the unknown, let's say. You say that it's important that we identify the most important target questions and come to grips with the fact that we might at that moment not know the answers to some of the really important questions.
This happens all the time. People make decisions that are driven by information, and yet the decision you're making is going to be based on information that you have to gather a lot of the time. If you don't admit that you don't know something and therefore need to gather more information, you're going to be making a decision either without information or with incorrect information that somehow has gotten to you. So we tell people, step back when you have a big decision to make and be realistic about what you know and what you need to investigate. And then we spend some time talking about how to get good information.
Well, right. And not just that, but to discard assumptions that you might be making that are not, in fact, valid.
People make many assumptions in day-to-day life. We could not get along in day-to-day life with any efficiency if we didn't make a huge number of assumptions. So we're good at making assumptions. But when we're making a big decision, we need to put that aside and say, okay, what's really going on here? And find that out. What is the real fact, not what I'm speculating about?
Right. As we gather information in step four, you give us, first of all, some really wonderful criteria. We don't have time to really go into them very much, but you pose the question, how do you know what information is reliable? And, you know, even if we're not confronting a big life-changing decision, it's still important. I mean, if you're just writing a term paper for school, it's important that we be equipped with a criteria for determining, is this information that I have come across legitimate, reliable, or not?
We spend a lot of time on that. You know, we're in an information society, so we've got a huge amount of text available to us on any subject. But some of that is reliable and some is unreliable. Because there's so much of it, we all have to become better at assessing bias, at looking at sources. When we see an opinion, is this a junk opinion or is this an opinion from someone who's really qualified to give me information that I'm going to use possibly to alter the course of my life?
And I'm so glad you mentioned the word bias, because at one point in this chapter you talk about caring bias, that we have to be on guard for the caring biases of our parents or friends and relatives. Explain what you mean by that.
People use bias a lot almost like a bad word. It really means something about the source of information that would cause the information possibly to be tainted. And so we think of bias as obviously someone is trying to sell us something, so therefore they may taint the information to make the product look good. But it's critical to recognize that bias also applies to people who want to do good for you. Parents are extremely biased advisors. Close friends are so biased that many people don't really rely on them at all when they make a decision, because the friends are often just trying to be supportive. So when you go to a friend and you give your friend a great business idea, the friend just nods and says, oh, that's fantastic, yes, you should pursue this. There's a real question whether you should leave your job based upon that advice, because your friend may say yes to just about anything you put out there.
Right. In chapter five, or step five, you are encouraging us to figure out the odds, reduce the uncertainties. I mean, really, once we've sorted out what the reliable information is. And you also say we need, at least to some extent, to ditch the anecdotes. You think we rely on anecdotes a little too much and don't realize how unstable they can be as a means towards a decision.
Anecdotes are all over the place in our society. It's become the principal form of entertainment for people to see snippet stories about how this celebrity succeeded or how this business person made $100 million. And we're bombarded with these, and they're very interesting, and we absorb them. But the question then becomes, how does this anecdote about another person who made a decision, for example, to start a business, affect my decision whether to start a business? And the big piece of advice that we give here is, don't sit around trying to find the similarities between you and this superstar of entrepreneurialism. Take a good hard look at the differences and see if this person had an advantage that you didn't have or that you don't have.
In step six, you talk about a very commonly held myth that the best decisions are made without emotion, that someone is doing themselves a favor if they discard their emotions at the point that they are trying to make a powerful emotion. You say that is not good advice at all.
Certainly when it comes to big decisions, and I would put aside decisions related to property because they are in a separate category where you should be pretty emotional. But other big decisions, by and large, are emotion-driven. And if you try to shut your emotions out and make a marriage decision or an education decision or a career decision, they upon what looks good in paper, the decision is probably going to fail. And it's going to fail because if you're going to carry out those decisions, you need to have emotional staying power. You need to have commitment. So doing something that looks good on paper when you lack that commitment is only going to be a temporary decision, because you may find yourself 3 or 4 months down the line without steam to go forward emotionally or in terms of the passion you bring to it to do it right.
You mentioned in step 7 the fact that sometimes we're talking about hard choices and sometimes short-term pain that we have to be willing to tolerate for the sake of a long-term goal.
You know, if you look at people who have made successful life decisions, the one fact that they all have in common is that they all have an ability to suffer pain today, financial cost, some kind of risk, emotional cost, to have that difficult conversation for the sake of making tomorrow a better day. And one of the questions I always ask people when I meet them is, do you tend to spend less than you could spend of the money that you make? And people who have achieved financial success almost always say yes. I always live slightly below my means or somewhat below my means. People who have financial trouble often say the opposite. They're living above their means. Now, what does living below your means mean? It means being able to say no at the store for the sake of building up that pile of savings that eventually will let you make those big moves without as much fear.
Hmm. Oddly enough, in step 8, you'd say that it maybe makes sense to be a brilliant procrastinator. And you're actually bringing to the table another misconception about decision-making, that good decision-making is done rapidly, right on the spot. You're saying that's really actually not the case.
There's a lot of worry out there about procrastination. It drives people crazy to believe that they can't make decisions fast enough. But when you look at people who've made great decisions, most of them are the world's craftiest procrastinators. They will only make the part of the decision that they have to make and that they're comfortable with. They will defer without even showing that they're deferring large parts of the decision, and they'll get out of decisions entirely that they don't want to make. And what I would recommend is that people spend less time worrying about their procrastination and more time figuring out what it is that they need to make the decision that is causing them not to make the decision. Sometimes it's a piece of information. Sometimes they're emotionally not ready. Sometimes they're financially not ready. The number of people who truly can't make up their mind and are, you know, real procrastinators is very small in my experience.
So we shouldn't sort of misdiagnose ourselves as procrastinators. We might not be, actually.
I would ask myself the question, if I'm having trouble making this decision, and this has gone on for a year or two, what is the problem? What am I missing? Am I not feeling comfortable with the information I have? Am I not emotionally ready? Or am I just afraid to say no? I think the decision's going to be no. I've got a person out there who I'd have to tell that. I don't want to hurt their feelings, and so I'm putting it off because I don't want to have that conversation.
You give us great advice on keeping the risk of failure in proper perspective, to not let that sort of loom over us and paralyze us. And you also say in step 10 that we should make a preliminary decision, but also maybe craft a really great plan B. Why is that helpful?
It's important to have backup plans and also to take steps before you make your decision to minimize the risks. Every good decision is going to have some risks. Yet, you don't necessarily have to accept those risks. You can sometimes work with them. And a simple example is, let's say I'm going to make a decision to do a substance abuse intervention. And I'm concerned that word is going to get around the family and other family members who are more distant criticize me for taking some strong action against a relative substance abuse. Well, one way to minimize the risk that I'm going to suffer that criticism may be to have a conversation in advance or contemporaneously with the intervention with more remote family members and give them a heads up and let them know what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, if that can be done still consistent with the privacy of the person who I'm intervening against.
Hmm. Interestingly, in your plus one step, you talk about the gut, the instinct. In fact, I think at one point in that chapter, you talk about how instinct can be like an angel, and that for all the important, hard and fast components of a decision that we need to reflect upon and consider carefully, that we should also not discard just gut instincts, that can also be a great aid in all of this.
When we use the term gut instinct, we're referring to what's more commonly known as intuition. Intuition is how a fact gets into our conscious mind other than through our rational faculty. That's why when we have intuitions, they seem to pop up. Study an issue, and everything says go right, and you say to yourself, no, I don't feel comfortable with right. I need to go left. That's an intuition. And it's hard even to explain where they come from because they don't come through our normal rational analytical process. They come from somewhere else, and we use our rational process to do our explaining. And that's why people say, I don't know why I feel this way, but I do. It's critical to understand your intuition, to pursue it, not to shut it out, because it could be the product of some analysis you've been doing with parts of your mind that are simply not the parts that you're focused on.
Hmm. Well, the book is a really thought-provoking one and potentially so helpful for anyone, and that means everyone, who is going to be confronting big decisions in their lives. The book is called Get Off the Fence, 10 plus 1 Steps to Help You Make That Big Decision, written by our morning show guest today, Jeffrey Makoff, along with Rhoda Makoff. The book is published by Health Communications Incorporated of Deerfield Beach, Florida. Jeffrey Makoff, I really appreciated the book and also enjoyed talking with you about it on the morning show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.